Now we read from Deuteronomy chapter 5. Moses summoned all Israel and said, "Hear, O Israel, the decrees and laws I declare in your hearing today. Learn them, be sure to follow them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. It was not with our fathers that the Lord made this covenant, but with us, with all of us who are alive here today. The Lord spoke to you face to face out of the fire on the mountain. At that time I stood between the Lord and you to declare to you the word of the Lord, because you were afraid of the fire and did not go up to the mountain. And he said, 'I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to thousands who love me and keep my commandments.'" Have you ever tried to find your way through a maze? Tried it once or twice. There are, of course, a variety of strategies that you can adopt in the endeavor. Most people, of course, in trying to solve the puzzle of a maze, do so by simple trial and error. They try one direction, and if that turns into a blind alley, they try another. This is invariably disastrous, of course, because the number of permutations of identical left and right turns that a maze presents you with is so many that you're reduced to a state of mental confusion in no time at all. Not only can you not work out which way to try next, you can't even remember which way you tried last. A less reckless technique is the one that was made famous in Greek mythology by Theseus, when he had to find his way through the famous labyrinth on Crete to kill the monstrous Minotaur. This is the ball of string method. The idea is that you tie a thread to the entrance of the maze and unwind it as you go. Of course, the weakness of the ploy, as you will readily perceive, is that whilst it may enable you always to find your way back to the place you started, it doesn't actually offer you any great assistance in finding the way out. Another technique, which claims at least to be more constructive in that regard, is the one that's recommended by Harris in the famous episode of the Hampton Court maze in Jerome K. Jerome's Three Men in a Boat, which coincidentally I also mentioned last week. This involves the application of a rule of thumb. In Harris's case, I seem to remember it was, always turn right whenever opportunity to do so presents itself. Now, it doesn't require great penetration of mind to realise that that sort of rubric is unlikely to be any more helpful than a ball of string at the end of the day. Turning right all the time is simply going to finish up walking around in circles, isn't it? Which, of course, is exactly what Harris realised he was doing when he passed the same discarded cream bun for the third time. Now, I want you to take my word for it. If you want to find success in this business of cracking mazes, there's only one dependable way to do it. Obtain a map. Now, I remember very clearly one occasion on Blackgang Chine in the Isle of Wight, where there is a maze. I was able to employ this strategy with great effect. I discovered before entering the maze that one could purchase, at very modest cost, an aerial photograph of the entire layout. These photos were hidden in a corner of the gift shop, and to my amazement, nobody seemed very keen on buying them. But I seized one eagerly, having been lost in mazes too often before to go for the old trial-and-error tactics again, and having no desire whatsoever to spend my afternoon following pieces of string or walking round in circles. Armed with my map, I launched into that maze with huge confidence and was soon tearing along its pathways with the certain air of one who knows exactly where he's going. I discovered others who were diffidently umming and ahhing at this junction or that junction, and my map enabled me to offer them authoritative advice, which I may say they gratefully accepted. Indeed, pretty soon I found I had a little following of foot-weary holidaymakers, keen to bring their peripatetic excursions in the maze to a speedy conclusion. And when we got to the exit gate, I received a pleasing number of relieved smiles, and many acknowledged wisely next time they would buy a map too. Now, I suppose the purists among you may be saying to yourselves, having a map destroys the whole point of a maze. Surely it spoils the fun, you are saying to yourself. Well, frankly, if that's your response, you haven't experienced enough mazes yet. I assure you that when exhausted in body and mind, you meet the same group of people wandering through the monotonous topiary that you passed half an hour ago. Fun is not the word that leaps spontaneously to your lips. Experimental psychologists put rats through mazes, don't they? And I don't suppose the rats find it much fun either. But the fact is, there is nothing enjoyable at all about getting lost in a maze, not after the first 5 minutes. That's why I want to talk to you over the next few weeks about one particular maze which we must each negotiate and which is potentially as lethal as that notorious labyrinth of ancient Crete where the Minotaur prowled. It's a huge maze, so vast it takes an entire lifetime to cross it. It's a complicated maze with twists and turns in a tortuously convoluted fashion, and so presents an endless number of enigmatic, brain-teasing alternative routes for the explorer. But most serious of all, it is a perilous maze. There are precipitous cliffs of fall and rushing cataracts. There are quicksands and minefields. There are villains who will seek to ambush you and sirens that will seek to seduce you. In short, I suspect Theseus might well have judged his labyrinth a more desirable assignment, Minotaur and all. For the maze I'm talking about is the moral maze. The maze into which every one of us is thrown as a result of our peculiar human faculty of self-determination. Unlike computers, which simply obey their programs, don't they? Computers especially. And unlike animals, which simply follow their instincts, we men and women, we choose our paths. Every day we make decisions, don't we? Voluntary choices between alternative courses of action. Choices that bear us to the right or the left, this way or that. It's out of such choices that the moral maze is constructed. Some people try to find their way through it by trial and error. Moral experimentalists, you could call them. But that method is doomed. It always ends in disaster, for this moral maze is far too hazardous a place to explore by hit-or-miss tactics like that. Some people use the ball of string technique. You must follow the wisdom of the ages, they say. Follow the route that is marked where others have gone before, which is very useful advice as far as it takes you. But it's not awful, or not always a lot of help when, as increasingly as we have to at the end of the 20th century, we face new kinds of moral decisions, for which there is no real precedent in human experience. The ball of string tends to run out and leave us stranded there. Still others believe there's a rule of thumb that always solves the problem. In every situation, do as you would be done by. Love your neighbour as yourself. Seek the greatest happiness of the greatest number, and so forth. Again, there's an enormous amount of wisdom in such golden rules. Jesus himself was the author of at least two of those I mentioned. But often, golden rules are not precise enough to handle with confidence the complexities of our lives. Sometimes it's very hard to calculate the greatest happiness of the greatest number. Often it is not at all clear what loving your neighbour actually demands. That is our problem. Too often, without additional information, a golden rule will just lead you round and round in indeterminate circles. Now, as with all mazes, there's only one way to successfully navigate your way through the moral maze. You must get yourself a map. A map that will enable you to decide with confidence between the alternative paths that life presents at just about every turn. Now, I'm here this morning to tell you that such a map of the moral maze is available. An aerial photograph of the whole field of human ethics taken by one whose superior vantage point gives him unrivaled authority when it comes to offering moral guidance. As with that aerial photograph of Black Gang Chine, surprisingly few people show interest in obtaining copies of this map these days. Perhaps they think it's more fun to struggle through life without it. But I have to tell you they're wrong. Because without the aid of the map, you are bound to get lost. You're bound to become confused. You may even run a very high risk of blundering into some voracious minotaur in the labyrinth of life. Now, my earnest recommendation is that you get a copy of the map and that you study it in great detail. Indeed, that's precisely our purpose in this coming quarter's Bible studies. For the map I'm referring to is nothing other than the law of God, inscribed in the pages of the Bible for those who have time to read it, echoed in the voice of our consciences for those who are willing to heed it, and summarized over 3,000 years ago on two tablets of stone written by the finger of God himself as the Ten Commandments. Those Ten Commandments are like triangulation points on an Ordnance Survey map. They constitute fixed landmarks on the horizon of the moral maze. They're not a full map, of course, in the sense that they don't enable you in advance to determine a detailed specification of the route you're going to take and all the choices that are going to confront you and which way you should go. But when interpreted against the background of the whole of the Bible, those Ten Commandments provide a kind of grid reference system within the moral maze. They enable you always to locate yourself and to determine in which direction you ought to be heading. That's what they're for. And it's that kind of general perspective on this vexed issue of making moral decisions that I want us to try and gain from our study of those Ten Commandments this term. You'll see that we start, if you look at the program card this morning, by looking at the first two of them under the title, Idols of Our Time. Let's note again from our reading what those two commandments are. Verses 6 to 8. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol. Maybe our initial reaction to that is to say, well, at least we're safe on these two commandments. I mean, our sexually permissive age may have problems with thou shalt not commit adultery. Our profit-motivated supermarket chains may have some embarrassment about remembering the Sabbath day. Our geriatric hospitals may be a little less full or would be visited a little more regularly if a few more children honored their father and mother, but when it comes to commandments number 1 and 2, we are surely exempt. No one could possibly accuse our 20th century Western society of being idolatrous, could they? I mean, you may find a greenhouse in the average suburban garden, but you're not going to find a totem pole. It's all part of what sociologists call secularization. To be an idolater, you have to have gods. And that's the very thing our secular 20th century is without. We are, in a very literal sense, godless. Or are we? Very important to understand that an idol doesn't necessarily have to be made of gold or wood. Nor do you necessarily have to dance around it or prostrate yourself before it in order to venerate it. The sociologist Emil Durkheim pointed out in the last century that religion is not simply an ecclesiastical power structure in society, nor does it necessarily have to deal with the realm of the supernatural. Sociologically, he said, religion is that which integrates our human experience and provides us with an overall understanding of the meaning of our life. It's vital for a society to have such a world view, he says, because it's out of that consensus of shared ideas that social cooperation, social cohesion arise. Now, defined in that broader sense, as those intuitions, those ideas, those powers to which we attribute absolute significance, from which we gain our sense of meaning in existence, interpreted in that sense, none of us are without gods. We all have a worldview. We all have some value-determining philosophy, don't we? In that sense, none of us are immune from the charge of idolatry. But what these commandments are saying to us are, is if we do not acknowledge the absolute authority of the God of the Bible over our lives, then we will invest other things with the devotion and the commitment that rightly belongs to him. They may not be supernatural things or even religious things, but they will be our sacred cows, nevertheless. And under this title, Idols of Our Time this morning, I simply want to offer you three observations, three tests, if you like, by which we may be able to identify the sinister presence of these idols even in our lives. Here are my three observations, or my three tests. First, we learn from these commandments that we will worship idols whenever we fail to acknowledge the moral authority of the true God over our conduct. Secondly, we learn that we will worship idols whenever we substitute other things for the true God at the center of our affections. And thirdly, we learn that we will worship idols whenever we entertain false ideas of the true God, born of our own created imagination. Look at those three things with me this morning then. First, we are worshipping idols when we fail to acknowledge the moral authority of the true God over our conduct. See how these Ten Commandments begin. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall. And that's really a preamble, not just to the first two commandments, but to the whole law code. And it's vitally important. Let me tell you why. The fundamental question that the moral maze puts to you and me, preliminary to every other dilemma with which it confronts us, is this. What's the ultimate difference between right and wrong? See, if there was no real difference between right and wrong, there would be no maze, would there? In that situation, all our choices would be trivial ones, based on habit, or expediency, or just passing whim. But no, deep down, all of us human beings have a kind of sixth sense, don't we, that right and wrong do exist. Now, I would like to do that, we may say to ourselves. Now, I usually do that. So, it would be to my advantage to do that, we may say to ourselves, but this is what I ought to do. Strange word, that, ought, no. The word of conscience, the word of obligation, the word that tells us we're not free to decide on the basis of personal preference alone, we are answerable to some higher principle, the principle of right and wrong. It's a word that's fascinated thinkers in every age, of course. Two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe the more steadily we reflect upon them, wrote the great philosopher Kant. The starry heavens above us and the moral law within us. Now, that's what that word ought implies, isn't it? A moral law within us. Just as the planets aren't free to roam the skies, but are bound by the law of gravity to keep a particular course around the sun, so we human beings, deep down, have an intuition of moral responsibility. We move within an orbit of permission which is defined by some inner force, by some law, the moral law. And the first question we have to ask whenever we face the moral maze, therefore, is where does this law come from? Well, the answer of the map is that it comes from God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall. It is he, then, who stands behind our sense of moral accountability. It's he who gives cogency to that mysterious word, ought. Because it's his unique divine prerogative to address our human beings in the moral imperative. You shall, he says. No one else can speak to us like that. Only God. So here's test one. You want to identify what your idols are. Then identify the source of moral authority in your life. Identify that, and you've identified your God. Humanists and rationalists, you see, would say morality is just a matter of doing what you calculate is for the best. When they say that, they deify human reason. Reason is their God. Fascists and communists would say, morality is a matter of doing as you're told. When they say that, they deify human authority structures. Their God is the party, or the state, or the Führer, hedonists and New Agers would say, morality is doing what furthers your own fulfillment. When they say that, they are deifying experience. Self is their God. The Bible disagrees with all these. These are all idols, it says, that have usurped the throne of the true God in human society. For there is only one God who can legitimately demand our moral obedience. Who is that one true God? Why, answers the map, he is the one who brought us out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. The God who has the right to command us is the God of salvation, isn't it? The God who has stepped into history to deliver us human beings when we could not save ourselves. He is the true God. He is the only one who has the right to say to our consciences, you shall. And he says it to us, not like a philosopher, because he can prove what he's saying is right. Not like a tyrant, because he can coerce us to conform to his will by force. Not like a guru, because it's in our spiritual best interest to accrue positive karma. Now, according to the map, the true God addresses us in that unique moral way, you shall, on the basis of his saving grace. He calls us to moral obedience by virtue of his saving grace in our lives. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Therefore, you shall. Of course, if he wants to, he can use these other methods. If he wants to, he can constrain our obedience through rational arguments. He can use rational arguments to support his law. He can constrain our obedience by penal sanctions. There are penal sanctions to enforce his law. If he wants to, he can constrain our obedience by offering satisfying rewards. There are rewards for observing his law. But none of these are his preferred method. According to the map, his means of establishing his moral credentials in his life are his grace, his saving grace. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of bondage, he says to us. I am the God who brought you out of the realm of darkness, out of the bondage of sin. That's why you shall. Now, it's very important that we get this straight. I'll tell you why. Historically, there have been two great errors about this whole business of the Ten Commandments into which people have habitually fallen. Error one says, you can get to heaven by obeying the Ten Commandments. That's called legalism. Error number two says, you can get to heaven by not obeying the Ten Commandments. That's called antinomianism. The legalist says, I'm saved by the law of God without the need for God's grace. The antinomian says, I'm saved by the grace of God without the need for God's law. And though legalism and antinomianism have repeatedly, throughout the history of religion and of the Bible, arisen, they are both dreadful mistakes. Because on the one hand, the Bible refuses to countenance salvation by works, and on the other hand, it equally refuses to give assurance of salvation without obedience. And in many respects, the key to understanding this difficult tension, which the Bible insists upon, lies right here in this little phrase in verse 6. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. This verse is reminding us of the God-ordained sequence of events through which ancient Israel passed. See, the journey of God's people didn't begin at Mount Sinai. God didn't say, I will deliver you from Egypt if you keep my commandments. That would have been legalism. But neither did their journey bypass Mount Sinai. God didn't say to them, I will take you to the promised land irrespective of any requirement of obedience on your part. That would have been antinomianism. No, he says, I have brought you out of the land of Egypt, and it is my determined intention to bring you into the promised land. Now, you shall. keeping the law, then, is not a condition of God's salvation or a payment for God's salvation, but it is a response to God's salvation, according to the map. It's so important to get that straight, you see. For many have a negative image of the Ten Commandments, don't they? They think of God as the heavenly spoil sport. Or was it somebody said, everything I want to do is either immoral, illegal, or fattening? Well, I don't know about fattening. I don't know about illegal. But it's certainly wrong to have a negative image of the moral law of God. Do you know in the Old Testament, poets wrote songs about the Ten Commandments? Songs that compared God's law to honey and to gold. To the legalist, maybe, the law tastes bitter, a chore to be endured. To the antinomian, maybe, the law seems valueless and irrelevant that can be ignored. But to the person who has experienced God's salvation, God's law is sweet and precious. For the religion of the Bible is, before anything else, it is a religion of gratitude. It's a religion that gladly renders obedience to God because he deserves it. He has been so generous to us. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. It's that attitude I want us to adopt as we come each week to these Ten Commandments. Not as pedants, not as anarchists, but as those who love the moral law of God because they love the moral law giver. And we worship idols whenever we fail to acknowledge his moral authority over our conduct. For if the God of salvation is not the source of moral authority in our lives, you may be sure something else is, and whatever else that something is, it is our idol. That brings us to the second test, the second observation. We worship idols, we learn here, whenever we substitute other things for God at the center of our affections. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me, it says. Now, scholars debate about whether that verse actually implies monotheism or not. Is God saying he's the only God that exists? Or is he merely saying that he's the only God worth worshipping? You can interpret that preposition before me both ways. It can be interpreted, for instance, beside me. Literally, what that preposition before means is, to my face. You shall have no other gods to my face. And the interesting thing about that phrase is it seems to have been a Hebrew idiom for bigamy. A man who took a second wife while the first was still living was said in Hebrew to have taken her to the face of the first spouse. And I have a feeling that may well be the intended background of the use of the preposition here. For a start, it makes sense of that rather unexpected word we encounter in verse 8, doesn't it? I am a jealous God, we read. Jealous gods, a little bit hard to imagine, but we're all familiar with jealous husbands. It also fits in very well with the very heavy emphasis you'll observe in the preceding verses of Deuteronomy 5 on the idea of covenant. Like in verse 2, the Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. You see, a covenant is a relationship, like marriage is a covenant. God is saying here, I am Jehovah, your God. You notice that that possessive pronoun. I belong to you and you belong to me because I brought you out of Egypt. And that's why I expect your fidelity. That's why I will countenance no rivals. That's why I tolerate no second spouse in my house. You shall have no other gods to my face. I am your true husband. It's interesting, actually, when you look at the Ten Commandments as a whole, that they're not drafted like a set of abstract principles given in the third person, are they? It is prohibited to do X. It is forbidden to do Y. Could easily have come to us like that. But no, these Ten Commandments are drafted
as an expression of an intense and intimate personal relationship that exists between this jealous God and this covenant people that belong to him. So he says at the very end of our reading, I show love to thousands who love me. That's what he's interested in. A loving personal relationship. And that's why he countenances no other God. For the same reason a husband will countenance no other men in his wife's affection. What's the first commandment, they asked Jesus? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. That, he said, is the very beginning of Christian living. That is the foundation of biblical ethics. And we will not even negotiate the first junction of the moral maze if we have not learned it from the map. I wonder if we have. We worship idols whenever we substitute other things for the true God at the center of our affections. That brings me to test two. You want to know how to identify the idols in your life? Here is the test. Where do you look for your personal security? What is your Linus blanket? What is the thing which, if everything else was stripped away from you, you'd cling on to and cling on to because your sense of security hinges on it? Identify that. That thing which is at the center of your affection. And you've found your idol. For many of us, I suspect, if you were honest, you would have to say it's our home. That home upon which we have invested so many mortgage repayments. That home upon which we have lavished such reverential care. Double glazing, conservatory extension, fitted carpets, three-piece suite, DIY, MFI, why oh why? Why oh why? Well, because our home is our security, that's why oh why. An Englishman's home is his castle, correction. At the end of the 20th century, an Englishman's home is his idol. Others of us, if we were going to have to be honest, would have to say, I think, that it's our children which are the focus of our personal security. Those children upon whom we heap such suffocating devotion. That those children for whose education we have made such momentous financial sacrifices. Those children by whose desires we are so imperiously ruled. By whose success we are vicariously bathed. For whose happiness we so parasitically exist. Oh, you say, how can you possibly speak about children like that? Children are the gift of God. Correction. For many families at the end of the 20th century, children are God. Idols. And if you don't believe me, you just study the adoring faces of the parents at the end of term concert. Oh, of course we could go on. We could speak about the idolatry of career. I must have a secure job. That's what makes so many people workaholics, isn't it? We could speak about the idolatry of health. Oh, I must have a secure body. That's why the Argos catalogue is so full of exercise machines and boots so full of vitamin pills. We could even speak of the idolatry of emotional wholeness. I must have a secure personality. That's why so many these days go to worship at the shrine of the psychotherapist. We are afraid, you see, aren't we human beings? By nature, we are afraid. We're so weak, so vulnerable. We fear poverty. We fear loneliness. We fear failure. We fear illness. Some of us just fear fear. Where do we look for security among all these fears? The first commandment says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. I am the source of your security. If we look for any other source of security, if we put anything else at the center of our affections, make anything else our liner's blanket, we worship idols. But that brings me to the third observation and the third test. We worship idols, we read here, whenever we entertain false ideas of God, born of our own creative imagination. Look at verse 8. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. Now, although Jewish and Christian commentators have sometimes argued to the contrary, it does seem that verses 6 to 10 are meant to contain two distinct commandments. The first one, you shall have no other gods before me, verse 7. And the second one, you shall not make for yourself an idol, verse 8. But if that's so, of course, the question must be asked, what's the difference between them? I mean, what is another god if it isn't an idol? And what's an idol if it isn't another god? Surely this is a tautology, just saying the same thing in different words. Well, no, they're not. Not if you think about it carefully. What we are faced with here, you see, are two different kinds of idolatry. You might call them first order and second order idolatry. Though in practice they may overlap and not always be easy to disentangle, they represent quite different kinds of sin. When Moses wrote, you shall have no other gods, he was forbidding the worship of foreign deities. But when he wrote, you shall not make for yourself an idol, he was forbidding the worship of the true God through man-made images. The first commandment then speaks of the sin of undisciplined affection, but the second commandment speaks of the sin of an undisciplined imagination. This is important. Some of us maybe were saying to ourselves when I was speaking about how some people make an idol of the family or the home, oh well, that may very well be true of all those materialistic people who aren't in church on Sunday. But of course, we are different. We are Christians, aren't we? The reason we're here on Sunday is to confess that we put God at the center of our lives, unlike so many secularized people in our 20th century. But you see, you don't have to subscribe either to pagan superstition or secular materialism to be an idolater of the second kind. Second-order idolatry thrives in a context of purported religious orthodoxy, precisely because it uses the language of God, the true God, but invests that language with corrupt, distorted, and erroneous meaning. Meaning that derives from our mind, from our imagination, not from his self-revelation. There are two classic examples of it, of course. In Protestantism, from which most of us, I guess, here come, this kind of second-order idolatry is most clearly seen in theology. I must have told you the story of the little boy who was painting a picture at school. What are you painting? The teacher asked him. Oh, I'm painting a picture of God. Silly, said the disreputable teacher. Nobody knows what God looks like. Well, they will when I finish painting his picture, said the little boy. Such is the naivety and the arrogance of childhood, isn't it? The little boy didn't know it, of course, but his precocious theologizing was of exactly what goes on in many of the theological departments of our universities and theological seminaries today. I wish I had a pound for every conversation with a theological student over the years that has begun, well, I like to think of God like this.
Which I'm always tempted to reply, well, I'm sure you do. I'd like to think of God in any number of ways. I'd like to think of God as one who'd never send anybody to hell. I'd like to think of God as one who'd permit me to indulge my lusts with no penal sanctions. I'd like to think of God as an avuncular Santa Claus who would never do anybody any harm. Oh, there are any number of ways I'd like to think of God. But I can't, can I? Such a self-manufactured deity would not be worth worshipping, for it would be an idol. We're not at liberty to shape God to our personal taste. That's what this second commandment's all about. We must bow to God as he reveals himself to be. This brings us to test three, you say. You want to know what idols you worship. Identify the source of your concept of God. Where do you get it from? Because if you get it out of here, if yours is a, I like to think of God like this kind of religion, it's idolatry. That's what it is. Christianity is a religion of revelation, not speculation. We worship idols whenever we substitute human imagination for God's self-disclosure. See, our choice is a matter of theology, are constrained by God's word, just as much as our choices in moral matters are. I've said before, I think idolatry is a sin of the intellect, just as adultery is a sin of the body. I may not do with my body what God says to be wrong, and I may not embrace with my mind pictures of God which God states to be false. In this respect, something that C.S. Lewis wrote about artistic creativity some years ago is very relevant. Let me read it to you. He says, "It seems to me that Christians ought to take their literature rather less seriously than cultured pagans do. The unbeliever is always apt to make a kind of hedonistic religion of his aesthetic experiences. He has to be, quote, creative. He has to obey a mystical, amoral law called, quote, his artistic conscience. He must be, quote, spontaneous rather than conventional, quote, original rather than derivative. Great authors are, quote, pioneers and explorers who are, quote, breaking fetters and bursting bonds all the time." Nothing, he says, could be more foreign to the law of Scripture. "If I have read the Bible right," he says, "it leaves no room for creative genius." Interestingly, our whole destiny, writes Lewis, lies in the opposite direction, in acquiring a fragrance which is not original to us, but borrowed, in becoming clear mirrors filled with the image of a face that is not ours. The goal of the Christian artist is not to bring into existence beauty and wisdom that didn't exist before, he writes, but to embody in his own art some reflection of an eternal beauty and wisdom which by definition lies beyond all words and pictures. And those seem to me to be very thought-provoking words, and they are relevant just as much to the Christian theologian as they are to the Christian artist. It is not the theologian's business either to be creative in that sense. On the contrary, he's to be a self-confessed plagiarist. For he has no new truth about God to discover, only old truth, revealed truth, which it's his task to express in a more contemporary, in a more relevant, in a more engaging way. That's why I say, you don't have to be a non-Christian to be an idolater of this second kind. Just, dare I say it, a liberal Christian. Just a Christian who gets his ideas from God, not from the Bible, but out of his own head. Such second-order idolatry, however, doesn't only affect theology. That's where it has corrupted most, it seems to me, in Protestant circles. But in Catholic circles, second-order idolatry has also had a very pernicious effect on worship. This, perhaps, is the most direct and obvious application of the Second Commandment in the world of religious people. You see what he says? you shall not bow down to them or worship them. You know the story of the mother wheeling her baby in the pram one day and being complimented by a passerby. Oh, what a beautiful baby you've got there, he said. Oh, that's nothing, replied the mother. You should see his photograph. That's exactly how some Christians are with God, you know. They're more devoted to his photograph than they are to him. Here's another, perhaps more dangerous illustration. I'm sure you know that it's possible for a man to become so obsessed with items of women's clothing that he's rendered psychologically incapable of normal sexual fulfillment. Fetishism, we call it. Well, if the first commandment prohibits spiritual promiscuity, when it says you shall have no other God before me, I think you could argue that the second commandment prohibits spiritual fetishism. The worship of the true God through devotional objects. And the religious world is full of it, of course, isn't it? Images of Mary, pictures of the saints, crucifixes, icons, holy relics. The veneration of such things is what worship is all about, I think we have to say, for many people. I suggest to you it won't do. It's a form of second-order idolatry. I have to say, I think, that over the centuries, some forms of Catholicism have turned the experience of many millions of its adherents into a kind of fetishism. Experience, rather than a real personal relationship with God. They are idolizing the photograph, not the living Christ. Now, I know some of you come from a Catholic background here, and some of you maybe are still Catholics, and I do apologize if I'm offending you in saying this. Yeah. You will know if you know me at all that I am by no means some kind of hot-pot Ian Paisley fanatic, and I do not often, if ever, very rarely, will you hear from this pulpit denunciations of Catholicism or indeed any Christian group. But it seems to me when we're looking at the second commandment, it just would not be right. I wouldn't be a faithful minister to you if I didn't point out to you the relevance of what this is saying to this issue. I know Cromwell went over the top. I readily grant that. The iconoclasts who smashed the statues and the windows of our cathedrals were criminals, and I am not seeking to defend their mindless vandalism any more than I would want to support those extremists who would say that having illustrated Bibles or using visual aids in your sermons is a breach of the second commandment. Nonsense. But the Puritan rejection of the veneration of images for all the excesses of Cromwell and his cronies was spiritually correct. Such veneration is dangerous. It deprives people of the real experience of God and substitutes a fetish in its place. The superstition and the spiritual darkness that characterizes vast tracts of continental Europe to this day, one has to say, are largely the result of a church which has taught simple folk to pray to the Virgin Mary when it should be teaching them to read their Bible. We may not make for ourselves pictures of God and fall down and worship them. We may read the revealed will of God in his word and obey it. That's what we must do. God is seeking those who love him and keep his commandments. And if you say a statement like that is intolerant, I can only plead with you that you look very carefully at what this second commandment says will be the consequence where this kind of idolatry is tolerated in a society. For he goes on to say, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me. Now, of course, many people are offended by that part of the text. It's unfair, they say. Very unfair for God to penalize the offspring for the sins of their forebears. I'm not sure that's actually what the text is saying. What Moses is in fact observing here is simply a fact of life. Religion is one of the most fundamental elements in any culture. And culture is simply the sum total of all those things which one generation passes on to the next generation. Culture is that which you do not get in your genes. Culture is that which you are educated into, inculcated into, that which is passed on to you through society. And that means, of course, if parents reject the true God in favour of other gods or man-made images of God, then that idolatry will not stop with them. It will be passed on in ever-increasing, ever-repeating cycles of error. It's not a case of God blaming the innocent for the sins of the guilty, but rather that when it comes to culture-wedded sins, like idolatry, the thing is inevitably transmitted through the generation, to the third and the fourth generation. And we have seen it happen. You ask, why is India underdeveloped today, when it has a civilization more ancient than ours? I will tell you why. Idolatry. Generations of pagan idolatry passed down from generation to generation over centuries. In the culture. It's embedded. You ask why rural France is in intellectual darkness. Why occult superstitions continue to occupy the minds of the people there that should have been thrown out in the Middle Ages. I will tell you. It is idolatry. Dare I say it, Catholic idolatry. Generations of it passed down from father to son over centuries. It's embedded in the culture. You ask why Western economies today at the end of the 20th century are struggling to sustain their prosperity and their growth. I suggest to you the reason is again, idolatry. Generations of materialistic idolatry. Materialistic idolatry which has now become so embedded in our culture, it is destroying us. Idolatry always bites the hands of those that feed it. And I assure you, if we perpetuate in our culture idolatry, then our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren will find it harder to believe in the true God because we have done so. The way we're made. But our text says it doesn't have to be like that, doesn't it? Notice the but in verse 10. But showing love to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. In closing, I want to tell you this. God has given us the one image we need if we are to worship him appropriately. Which is not a man-made image, but a heaven-sent image. No one has ever seen God like the Apostle John. But the only Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has made him known. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. You shall not bow down to anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath, says the second commandment. But Paul tells us in the New Testament, one day, everything in the heaven above and on the earth beneath will bow down to Christ. For he is the one image of God it is legitimate to worship. He is the one image of God which we shall worship. And the Bible invites us to anticipate that day. We call you now to worship as Lord of all. To have no gods before him, their thrones must fall. The Bible invites us to abandon those idols then and serve the true God. There is a promise for those who do. Showing love to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. He will not hold our idolatrous culture against us. He will not hold our idolatrous past against us. He assures us he's willing to forget those insults against his sovereign majesty. He will start again with us. He wants a loving relationship with us. but one which is based on obedience. See, the moral maze is a difficult and a dangerous labyrinth to explore, and we all have to cross it. So get the map. The commandments of the true God. Get the map. It will keep you on the right track, will that map. But better even than the map, get the guide. You know, when Harris and three men in the boat got completely desperate, you know what he did? He climbed on someone's back, waved his arm in the air, and shouted, "Help." And sure enough, the proprietor of the maze came and got them out. Maybe our problem, as we hear these words this morning, is that we have got ourselves well and truly lost in a muddle. Well, whatever remote corner of the maze we may have got ourselves enmeshed in, wave your arms about and shout help. He will come. He will give you the map. And he'll make sure you don't get lost again. Let's pray together.